ready.
Yeah, we're blue. All right.
Today is June 1st, 2017. This is Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. It is 4:30. Thanks for being here. We're planning to do a marathon hearing for the next couple hours, so thanks for joining us.
Hey.
Don't worry, we're bringing in dinner for us. We're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2391 relating to access to health care, and we'll call up. Miss Ames, why don't you kick us off first?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, on OLIS, you will notice there is a dash one amendment posted. We know it needs changes, but it was a place to start on the discussion. And there's also a presentation that we'll start with and some supplemental materials.
All right. So with that, we'll call up Jeremy Vandehay and Pat Allen.
Good afternoon. Chair Rayfield, Chair Stanard Hayward. For the record, I'm Jeremy Vandehay, Health Policy Advisor to Governor Kate Brown. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. And I'm joined with Director of DCBS, Pat Allen. I'm going to kick us off and then turn it over to Pat about halfway through for a couple of the slides. Just before I start, just a couple, key points. As you all know, the Oregon Health Plan budget is probably the biggest challenge before you all this session in terms of funding, and that's primarily is due to result of a loss of revenue that has to be made up in order to continue the progress program. And there's been a lot of work that's been going on for about 9 months now. Throughout the session with discussions with legislative leaders, with stakeholders, to try to find a framework that has generally broad support to try to resolve the challenges that were before you. So as Linda mentioned, there are dash ones on OLIS, but there's dash twos that are going to be quickly coming. And I think today we just want to provide a general framework of the budget package that's been worked on and is coming together. So let me just give a little bit of background first and leave you in suspense before I get into the meat and potatoes. So you all have had a lot of presentations, I know, over the last several months on OHA's budget, but just a quick recap in terms of why do we have this funding challenge. As you all know, the Oregon Health Plan is a state-federal partnership with the state picking up a part of the cost of the program and the federal government picking up the majority of the cost of the program. The challenge, the funding challenge here is not a result of unsustainable cost growth or cost growth that I would say is sort of out of control. We've actually done a really good job as a state containing costs. We've in previous years have had cost growth of 7-8% per capita, but over the last 5 years through CCOs and our commitment to the federal government have reduced costs to and held them down to a 3.4% trend. And from a total funds perspective, we're actually expecting that this budget will be about the same or potentially even lower from the 15-17 to 17-19 biennium. But the challenge is really the makeup of the state and federal funds, and that has come from a reduction of federal funds across the board on both the traditional and the ACA part of the program, from reductions in match rates on both, as well as ending one-time funds, namely about nearly $200 million of ending hospital tax balance from the last biennium that was rolled over into this biennium, and the ending five-year investment from the federal government in our previous waiver. Just to illustrate the change in match rates here, in the current biennium, for every dollar spent on the Oregon Health Plan, about 21 cents of that is state funds, and the remaining 79 cents is federal funds. Actually, previous to the ACA, that was more like a 36-64 split, but because we're receiving such a high match on the ACA, it has come up. But that will back down in 17-19, and it'll be more about a 25-cent, 75-cent split, which doesn't seem a huge difference, but when you're talking about a $15 million budget, it makes a pretty big difference. So why is this important? Obviously, having health care is good for people's health, and it's good for the well-being of individuals and families in Oregon. But it's also critical for the state economy to be able to have people have health insurance and to reduce the uninsured rate. Under the ACA, Oregon has reduced the uninsured rate from about 17% to about 5%. Just a couple of years ago, nearly one in five Oregonians didn't have health insurance. Today, 95% of all Oregonians in the state and 98% of all children have access to health care coverage. And this has been huge, not just for those individual families. This has also been important for the health system and stability within the health system. It's been important for the economy, and particularly in rural parts of the state. There's some counties that nearly 40% of residents there rely on the Oregon Health Plan for their health care coverage. And funding the ACA expansion will draw down about $5 billion of additional federal funds into the 2017-19 biennium. As I mentioned, the ACA isn't the only thing leading up to this challenge, but obviously not being able to solve this piece of it would leave a lot of federal dollars on the table. While we've also expanded coverage, uncompensated care is down. There's a significant amount of more care that previously was uncompensated that is now being compensated. We've heard stories of, for instance, the hospital in Burns, who was able to go from three physicians to five physicians in that county as a result of being able to expand coverage and reduce uncompensated care. And it's also been a job growth indicator as well. Since 2014, we have 23,000 new healthcare jobs in the state. So in terms of process, as I mentioned, we've been talking about this for about 9 months now, if not longer. The governor had a stakeholder work group that began this discussion in September and tried to put forward some solutions. They weren't able to ultimately get to consensus on recommendations, but was a great in terms of beginning to start to flesh out what some potential solutions could be. She put out her budget in early December that had both a share of cuts and revenue across the agency, across insurers, CCOs, across hospitals, but was also very clear that that was really a starting point and was open to other solutions. You all have picked this up. This legislative session and the legislative work group was convened in March for many Friday afternoon meetings and hours. And you all invited some, not everybody on this committee, but there was a committee of some work group of some members of this committee and some other members who, you know, have been talking with stakeholders, had invited stakeholders in to try to hear different proposals on what potential solutions could be out there. And there's been just ongoing conversations, both from legislative leadership, from members of that work group, from folks within our office, on trying to figure out what a middle ground or compromise could be on a framework. And what we're going to outline today is the framework that has come out of that work group, as well as conversations with stakeholders that we think there's not I wouldn't say complete consensus, but there's seems to be general broad support for the framework. There's basically three bills. This would be broken up into what the one we're talking about today, House Bill 2391, would contain the policy changes and, in particular, the tax votes. There's one technical fix related to the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool ending fund balance. That account actually sunsets on June 30th, and so the plan would be in a separate vehicle. Just has an issue. It's just an issue related to effective dates of trying to push out that a couple of months to allow enough time for 2391 to take effect. And then there's several components of this package that don't require statutory changes that will just be wrapped up into the OHA budget bill. Last slide here before I get into numbers. What would this package provide should it pass? First of all, it would continue the progress we've made as a state, both on transformation and on expanding coverage. We would be continuing to move forward as a state. Would, I think, avoid a major disruption of having to go backwards, of losing the ground we've made on reducing the uninsured rate. It does not include any reductions in eligibility or benefits. Maximizes federal funding. I wouldn't say down to the dollar of every single dollar we could leverage. There are some cuts in tightening the belt, but to the extent that we're trying to leverage federal dollars, as I mentioned, by funding the ACA expansion, would be able to leverage about $5 billion to the state. And I think this reflects some shared responsibility and a shared alignment across the health system for helping try to pitch in and find a solution. Everybody is going to have to bear some responsibility in this package. And then finally, there's a market stability program not related directly to the Oregon Health Plan, but to address issues related to stability within the individual market. The program, this package would include standing up a reinsurance program to help stabilize that market, which Pat will talk about in a little bit. So let me get into to numbers here. We started this session with a $917 million gap on the for the Oregon Health Plan. The framework, and there's a more detailed listing of this that is on OLIS. It would include $71 million in agency savings and cuts and cost containment. And that's a combo of some initiatives that the agency would undertake to reduce costs. And an example of that is committing to reducing unintended pregnancies. It also includes some actual administrative cuts to the agency. $36 million would come from a lower or reduced rate of growth for CCOs. This is not fully funding up to the 3.4%. It would be funding to a lower amount. And I should also note that some of these do have federal dollars attached to them, so the actual impact to stakeholders feels like a little bit more than this, and the document that's on OLIS outlines some of that. About $100 million in what I guess I would categorize as revenue adjustments. This is both an ending fund balance or a unallocated fund balance for the hospital tax, some changes in expected drug rebate. And just to be clear on the hospital tax piece, this is really after the tax is repaid, after all of the programs are funded, there's sort of an unallocated amount that hasn't been allocated to the Oregon Health Plan yet. There's the discontinuation of the Hospital Transformation Program would redirect $68 million state funds, plus the federal dollars that are attached to that, to medical services within the Oregon Health Plan. This was HTPP was a program that was stood up in 2013 to create a quality incentive payment to hospitals. I don't think anybody... clearly a priority of the state is to continue to pay for performance, but frankly, we had more room within the hospital tax to be able to utilize it to create this program, and this package would redirect those dollars to pay for medical services in the budget gap as opposed to this incentive payment. Next, there would be an increase in the hospital assessment on the DRG. So the current hospital assessment program is just on what are called DRGs. Those are the larger mostly urban hospitals. Increase the rate from the current 5.3 to 6.0. And this has been called the true tax of 0.7. And the reason for that is for up to the 5.3, hospitals receive an enhanced payment to, in essence, repay the tax in the aggregate. We cannot, as a state, commit to holding in any of them individually harmless under federal law, but we do have an enhanced payment that we pay back to them to sort of collectively repay the tax. But for this amount from 5.3 to 6, the entire amount of that revenue would be put towards the OHP budget hole. Some of it does support hospital services, but also goes to other services as well. Next, there would be an addition of the rural adding the rural hospitals into a hospital assessment program as well. As long as the hospital assessment program has been in the works since 2003, what we call Type A and Type B hospitals, these are 32 smaller rural and critical access hospitals, have never been included in the assessment. This was actually a proposal that was brought forward by the hospitals. It wasn't one that the legislature or the governor put out there, but in talking with several of the CEOs, I think they would categorize it as not something that necessarily is their first choice, but something that they've decided to put forward, acknowledging that they too have benefited from or will benefit from filling this budget gap. You'll note that it's at a lower level, and there's a couple of reasons for that. One, I want to make sure that we get this thing off the ground and don't in any way jeopardize the finances of those hospitals. And secondly, this would operate current similar to how the current DRG program works, and that they would receive an enhanced payment back. Again, we can't hold them individually harmless, but we can provide enhanced payments back to them. And the only way to really make sure that doesn't turn into a situation where you're taxing more than what you can return in enhanced payments is by having some room in terms of what the tax rate is. And so we would want to include a lower tax rate to be able to adjust that up and down if needed. Next would be creating an intergovernmental transfer program with OHSU that would net $105 million to the budget hole. This acknowledges OHS. This is something OHSU brought forward to help with the budget challenge. They are in a unique situation as a public entity, and so an intergovernmental transfer can work a lot like a provider tax. The rules are slightly different at the federal level, and so basically this would carve them out of the current hospital tax program and put them into a new intergovernmental transfer program with the state. And then next would be a new managed care insurer tax that is along the same framework of what existed from 2009 to 2013, but at a rate of 1.5%. That tax was at 1%. Part of this would go to fund a reinsurance program, which Pat's going to talk about in a little bit. About $205 million, though, would go towards the Oregon Health Plan budget pool. And then finally would be a general fund increase of $139 million to the budget. This was the general fund increase that was in the co-chair's framework that came out earlier this session. If you do all of those things, that adds up to $934 million, which is, you'll notice, actually $17 million over the budget challenge. And this was sort of the final framework that came out of the legislative work group. Let me kick it over to Pat now.
Great, thanks. Patrick Allen, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Just quickly a little bit about the insurer's CCO tax. Similar to Jeremy's windup, I've got some points to make and then some numbers that lead into where we are. First of all, in federal law, provider taxes around insurers and providers need to be broad-based, uniform, and as Jeremy mentioned, with the hospitals not promise specific payments back to specific taxpayers. And so when we look at tax rates across insurance companies and CCOs, we need to be able to maintain equivalence across those. The tax would primarily fund OHP with a portion going to a reinsurance program. Let me talk briefly about kind of the why of that. When we think about stability in the market, we're really talking about how to avoid significant changes that could occur in a number of places. A significant reduction in funding of OHP leaves lots of people uninsured, which drives uncompensated care. Similarly, in the individual market, if we end up with lots of disenrollment from that market, we end up driving costs. And those costs spread across the entire market, whether it's public programs, small and large group programs, or self-insured employers. And so what we're trying to do in both these areas is to preserve the enrollment that we have across these markets that results in 95%, a 95% insurance rate. We would use largely a small piece of the insurance tax, but then some existing fund balances that relate to previous individual market insurance activities to fund that, and I'll go into some detail about that. We would also seek a federal Section 1332 waiver for partial funding of this program. We've been invited very aggressively, actually, by CMS to pursue this. This was an approach pioneered by Alaska within the past year that basically says if you have a reinsurance program, that will tend to drive rates down from what they otherwise would be, and that means federal subsidies will go down, and so there's a willingness to share the benefit of that reduction in federal subsidies through this 1332 program. We do believe that the reinsurance program would have a net effect on rates of driving rates in the individual market down by about 4.9 percentage points. When I think about the value of reinsurance, I really think, though, of two components. One, we're already seeing the effect of now, and that's really psychological benefit. It's a confidence in the market benefit for the insurance companies themselves and their willingness to be in a market and exposed. This it takes a layer of risk that they know that they don't need to price into rates. And so I think when we look at the geographic pattern of the filings we have now, unlike a number of states, we don't have any counties in Oregon that don't have any carriers. We have multiple carriers in almost all counties and are still actually working on conversations with carriers to make sure we've got at least two carriers in each county. And that's, I think, due at least in part to the fact that we're pursuing this and we'll be able to see rate benefits if we're able to get this program put into place.
One last thing about reinsurance, the way a program like this would simply work is there's what's called an attachment point where for a given claimant, claims over a certain dollar amount, and then up to a maximum dollar amount would be borne by the reinsurance program rather than by the insurance company. And so you're able to take that predictable level of risk and be able to take it out of the base. A couple of slides ago, you saw $205 million as the contribution to the Oregon Health Plan to get there. The 1.5% tax on CCOs would generate $80 million. Applying that tax to the self-insured portion of PEB would generate an additional $10 million. And then the insurer portion would be about $145 million. You add to that one-time sources related to the existing health insurance marketplace fund balance, as well as the remaining funds from the transitional medical insurance pool reinsurance program for $57 million, and then our projection of what a waiver would generate, that gets you total resources of about $341 million, 205, or the number you saw previously being contributed to the health plan, and the remainder goes to the reinsurance program over the course of the biennium. The financial calculations get a little bit weird on this because reinsurance programs operate on calendar years versus fiscal years, and so you've got some portions of this program that would occur in multiple biennium.
So let me just real quickly wrap up two last points. One on the amendments, as I mentioned, the dash ones, we expected, this is a fairly complicated set of amendments. We expected they would be not perfect, and we're hoping to kind of wait till we had dash twos that were a little cleaner, put them out there. But we did go ahead and put ones out there because we wanted to make sure people had an opportunity to start reading this and understanding it. But there will be dash twos coming very quickly with a number of things, mostly technical, but a couple of still things we're trying to sort of work through. And hopefully we'll have those anytime. Finally, just a couple of other notes for you to consider. One, I think there's been I want to first of all thank the legislative work group, thank stakeholders, legislative leadership who have been working really, really hard on this. This is not easy. We realize that, you know, even for folks who have said they support this, this also requires tightening belts in a way that is not necessarily going to be easy, requires, you know, includes taxes that maybe not everybody really wants to swallow. And we recognize that and also recognize that there's going to be a significant amount of work over the next 6 months to implement several pieces of these. Work with stakeholders, with the agency, and several pieces that will require CMS approval. And so, one, just want to thank everybody's hard work on this to date, and also want to acknowledge and I guess just tee up that I think there's going to have to be a lot of collaboration going forward, and I think everybody so far has signaled that they're willing to dive in and continue to work on this on the implementation and the interim.
So with that, questions? Yes, Representative Hayden.
Thank you. You mentioned the technical fix to the OMIP program was House Bill 3398. Is there amendments coming to that? Because that's a task force for hunger.
Yeah, I am not aware that the amendments have been released yet or if they're even in the process of being drafted, but that was the vehicle that I think was indicated would likely be one that could be used for that. And Representative Hayden, first of all, I appreciate you dropping off a copy of your bill today, and I know that you had an alternative idea for that. I will say that I think in terms of the thought process of using that ending fund balance for reinsurance, what really came from, Pat can probably talk a little more detail if you have more questions, but it was really about trying to sort of keep to the original intent of those dollars were originally for a reinsurance program and rolling them over, but appreciated
well, now you have your amendment.
Your willingness and continued discussion to figure out how to help solve this budget challenge.
Representative Bueller.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Rigdon. So I'm curious about more details about the premium tax. So who actually pays, what insurers actually pays the premium tax?
Co-chairs, Representative Bueller, that would be all insurers in the commercial health market, with the exception of certain government programs like Medicare supplements and those kinds of things. So small group, large group, and individuals.
I have a serious question.
Please.
That's different than my answer. I didn't think that large group would be included in this.
Co-chairs, Representative Bueller, large group would be because that's fully insured business. You may be thinking of self-insureds, which would not be captured in this.
Okay. So, what would prevent a large group from just switching over to self-insured? Why wouldn't they flee this market when they see this tax coming down?
Yeah, there's a. It's not free to make a change from being insured to being self-insured. There would be startup costs and other transaction costs that would go with that, and so it's a, it would be a financial calculation.
Pat, people do that all the time. I've seen, you know, my own business has looked at that. It's not that hard to do.
No, I'm not suggesting it's impossible. I'm saying it's going to be a financial calculation, and the question will be, for most businesses, will a percent or a percent and a half be the breaking point that would cause them to do that? And you can get a variety of opinions of exactly where that point is. We think it would not be a significant factor.
So what do you expect rates to do with this tax?
In the individual market, co-chairs Representative Bueller, the net decrease after accounting for the tax and accounting for the value of the reinsurance would be a reduction of 4.9% approximately across the entire market. That would vary from carrier to carrier and so forth. And there would potentially be a net increase in the small and large group markets equivalent to the tax. Now, in the absence of that, if we in fact have a significant collapse in the individual market, correspondingly you would see significant increases because of cost shifting in the small and large group markets.
So let me just repeat what I thought. So the small and individual group are going to see an increase in premiums, and large is going to see a decrease?
No, the other way around. Individual will see a decrease. It's about 250,000 lives, and then the lives in the small and large group markets would see an increase.
Small and large.
Small and large group.
Question,
please.
And what do you project our deficit being in the next biennium when we see the next ratcheting down of federal support for the expansion population?
Co-Chair Fields, Representative Bueller. So in terms of the ACA piece right now, I mean, obviously it will depend on caseload. We were at a number earlier in session; it would be roughly around $190 million, just accounting for that final pickup of the ACA.
So why so much more this biennium than in the next biennium? Doesn't it ratchet down the same percentage now?
Yeah, Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Bueller, the challenge this biennium really is not just the ACA, and I know that's been sort of a lot of what people have talked about, and I've even talked about it a lot in this presentation, but really the budget challenge came from both a change in match rate on the ACA, a change in match rate on the traditional part of the program. The ACA part was prescribed in the ACA, it was a step down, everybody got the same match rate, and then it backs down to 2020. On the traditional part of the program, that is a formula that's based off of economic conditions of a state compared to the rest of the country. It's sort of outside of our control. It goes up and down. And so that we're sort of at the whim of that formula. And then there's also some reductions in tobacco tax and some other funds that from the state share of the program and the ending one-time funds. There was $195 million of hospital tax that was rolled over into this biennium, and there was the $136 million of the final waiver dollar. So you add all that up, and that's the vast majority of the $917 million.
Whenever it's my turn.
Senator Caton.
Thank you.
Representative Senator Caton.
So thank you, Co-Chair Representative Rayfield. This might get a little technical, but I want to talk about DCBS 1332 waiver, which was written by Ron Wyden. It's in the original ACA. You made reference to the Tom Price letter that strongly encouraged states to apply for a 1332 waiver. There's 8 or 10 states that are doing that, but the only one that appears to be moving forward with federal communication is Alaska's, in which once they have a 1332 waiver, they can set up this reinsurance program that would allow the insurance companies to have a separate pool for pre-existing conditions, correct?
Co-Chairs Representative Hayden, that's not quite the way I understand it. First, Alaska is out of the gate first because they created a reinsurance program last year solely using state funds. Also, they only have a single insurance company, and so the structure of their program can be somewhat different than other states may consider. I also understand that Minnesota has moved quite far down the path of pursuing a pursuing a waiver. I don't believe that Alaska's is structured as a high-risk pool in the sense of identifying specific individuals and attaching to those specific individuals, which is much the way our previous reinsurance program worked. But in any case, ours would be structured looking at a layer of risk across the market rather than trying to track to individuals.
Okay, so I understand that. And I think we're saying the same thing there, and it does get technical. And then looking at the American Health Care Act for individuals with pre-existing conditions, I realize that is not current federal law, and it may not be. But I think it's prudent for us to look at what could be coming down the pike. My understanding in that legislation is that it would you would be required to have a 1332 waiver in order to have the insurance companies have a separate pool for people with pre-existing conditions. Is that correct?
Co-chairs, Representative Hayden, I think that's largely correct. There's discussion of a waiver in the language that we have seen. I don't know that it attaches to 1332 specifically or not, but it's the same notion that we would apply for if we were to choose to apply for a waiver to allow for carriers to do something different on pre-existing conditions, and then required with that would be our establishment of some kind of a high-risk pool or reinsurance program to go with it.
Okay, so the point is, I just be cautious about what we're doing here with creating another reinsurance program that could or could not benefit us in the future.
If I could just make one comment, I agree completely. I think that's we're trying to be careful not to characterize this program as a sort of a long-term permanent fixture of healthcare finance in Oregon. We're looking at this as a bridge program to get us to whatever the future is going to look like. Everything that we've seen, including the American Health Care Act, appears to indicate that 18 and largely 19 would be similar to the way they function now, and that's really what this is aimed at, is trying to get through that period. Oddly, at one point, CMS was requiring us to make a five-year commitment to doing a reinsurance program under 1332, which didn't really make a lot of sense with legislative direction there, and they've backed off that since. But I absolutely point well taken, and we're keeping an eye toward that.
Yeah. Senator Winters.
Just a quick question. Is this the first time that we've ever had the insurers in the provider assessments?
Co-Chair Redfield, Senator Winters, no, it is not. There was an insurer managed care tax from 2009 and 2013. And our direction to legislative council, to the extent possible, has been to basically keep the same framework that existed. Obviously, the rate is higher.
Thank you.
Representative Bueller.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Redfield. So Pat, explain in more detail what's driving down the rates, even though we have this premium tax.
Co-Chairs, Representative Bueller, the idea behind reinsurance is that actuarially a plan can be assessed for what portion of its claims will fall within, in this case, the band of claims that will be covered by reinsurance. And so a carrier will be able to assess the morbidity of its portfolio of customers and make a determination that it'll have an impact on rates because their net claims cost will be lower, and it'll be lower by more than the amount of the tax that they would pay.
So do the insurers agree with your actuarial analysis of this situation?
We think that that's the number across the market is an accurate number. How that plays out with each carrier will vary, and that would be a part of the rate setting process that that we would need to go through.
Senator Winters.
How many other states actually do similar models to what we're currently doing in building provider assessments? And it's not just dealing with, as I understand it, just the hospitals, and in this case, with the insurers. But aren't there other kind of models that are out there that states are doing for leveraging dollars in order to pay for health care costs?
Co-Chair Redfield, Senator Winters, a couple points there. First of all, 49 other states do leverage provider taxes. Alaska, I believe, is the only state that does not, that ranges from one to more than three, but I think three is actually the most common. We have two right now, long-term care care tax and the hospital assessment. There's I think 18 categories within federal law of different provider taxes that you can have, but they tend to clump around the hospital, insurer, and a handful of others due to what is easiest to administer. Some of them are get a little bit more complicated to administer.
Representative,
continuing on the follow-up, I was 1332. You have planned on page 8 here for the marketplace using the OMIP transfer funds and a few other funds in there in the $57 million. Those are one-time dollars, so once we get through this biennium, you've set up a reinsurance that hopefully stabilizes the cost and in theory would reduce a few percentages or 0.15% in theory or 2% of the insurance rate. You're using one-time dollars to fund that. So we go forward into the future. Is that $57 million calculated into your forecast of being $190 million short in the next biennium?
So, Coach Arryfield, representing, let me take a first stab at this, and then I'm gonna kick over to Pat. So, on the insurer CCO tax, what is in the bill is just a 2-year, eight quarter. Program, so it would sunset after 2 years, and the funding you have on here is for a funding package for 2 years. And so, if the program would be extended, yes, you're correct, there would have to be a different type of funding package or an extension of this. The problem with, I think, the benefit of putting the dollars towards reinsurance is that this is a 2-year program, and so you can have a conversation in 2 years about what's the right funding mechanism if the program continues. The challenge of putting it in the Oregon Health Plan budget is exactly what you stated. If you use it to backfill part of the 917, then you do have a hole you still have to fill in 2 years.
So a follow-up? So follow-up, I mean, you know, just to be clear, this plan is the same in my mind because you just have a 2-year plan. You're using one-time funds. How does that argument differ from putting the funds into OHP to cover it for the biennium?
Yeah, Coach Arryfield, Representative Hayden, let me try this a different way. So, first of all, you're correct that it is one-time funds, and that it will come to you can use it one time, and that's it. Part of this package and part of the discussion among the legislative work group was a concern around limiting the use of one-time funds on the OHP side, out of concern of that we would do have that additional 190 to pick up, and not wanting to sort of add to that if at all possible.
We're essentially using those $57 million to finance the wind down of the Affordable Care Act, and Congress and the administration are committed to generating a follow-up system that's more stable and has lower rates, and so I'm confident we won't need to go to that well.
Your confidence is noted.
Further questions? All right. I do have one quick question. And you referenced, Mr. Allen, cost shifting without the program, potential cost shifting that could occur. And it was just kind of if you could just, elaborate on that and what that might look like.
Sure. Whether we're talking about people losing coverage through the Oregon Health Plan or we're talking about significant loss of coverage in the individual market, you return to a world that we were in before where we had lots of people who don't have health insurance that still get, albeit inadequate, healthcare treatment, then it tends to be expensive healthcare treatment, and it tends to be borne by providers. Those providers shift those costs on in their contract rates to insurers or self-paid self-insured employers. And so one of the big benefits that we've gotten out of getting that insured rate down or up to 95% is that we have sucked a lot of that cost shifting out of the system. And what we're trying to do by trying to stabilize both these markets is to avoid going back to that system and having those costs shifting in different directions. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you very much. Any other questions?
Yes, Representative Hayden.
Thank you. Okay, moving on to, thank you, Chair Rayfield. Moving on to the DRGs, the floating average of 5.3% now, and moving that to a 0.7 more, or basically 6%, brings in $120 million if that 0.7 is a permanent tax. If that 0.7 were a additional to the assessment, not a permanent tax, but an additional to the assessment, some of our smaller DRG hospitals, particularly the Bay Area hospital that's not included in the OHSU intergovernment transfer, would potentially really be hurt by that being a permanent tax because they're not held harmless. They don't get made whole for that. And your budget proposal is close to that $20 million gap. Why is it necessary? I guess I just don't see the necessity to require the 0.7% to be a permanent tax when it is really going to disproportionately hurt some of our smaller DRGs, if you can call them that.
Could Chair Fields, Representative Hayden, a couple of points. What you'll note in the bill, in the dash ones, is that additional 0.7 for 2 years. Secondly, if you reduce the, if you sort of treat the 0.7 as you do the current program where you enhance the reimbursement back to the hospitals, the challenge is you reduce the 120, in essence. They reduce the amount that's for the budget challenge.
By about 20 million, correct?
I think it'd be higher. I think it'd be more like 30, but I can get you that number.
Okay. I recall from committee it was roughly 105 to 126, but that may have, it did constantly change. So,
Representative, I'm happy to get you that exact number.
Okay, thank you.
All right, further questions? All right, seeing none, thank you both.
Thank you.
And we have one person signed up for public testimony, Phil Greenhill. And if there's anybody else who wants to testify with Mr. Greenhill, should come up now. While you're going to come up, it looks like James Sparta is going to leave.
Thank you, co-chairs Steiner Haywood, co-chairs Representative Rayfield, to the committee. For the record, my name is Phil Greenhill. I'm the chief from Coos Bay. I'm the chief executive officer for Western Oregon Advanced Health, CEO for Southwestern Oregon IPA. It's a large physician group on the South Coast. Currently president of the Coalition for Healthy Oregon, as you know as COHO, and one of three chairs along with Kelly Kaiser from Samaritan and Janet Meyer from HealthShare that have worked over the last several months to pull the collaboration of all 16 CCOs together to work on the problem that you've just heard discussed as far as the budget hole and the collaboration of those CCOs, or better known as an effort to herding cats as we try to get all those people together into one room. But in a collaborative effort, we have been meeting with the Oregon Health Leadership Council, the Hospital Association, and the commercial insurers over the last few months in an effort to be actively involved in trying to find a solution to the budget problem that we're presented with in Oregon and to continue with the transformation efforts that we've had underway for a number of years. I would first like to thank this body and the total legislature for the commitment we've had the last few years. Many of you have been actively involved in that. Many of you I've worked with myself and others to see that we could move transformation forward in our state, and I think we've had great success in that direction. Now we're challenged with how we keep our system efficient at the same time, so with the right funding in place to make sure that we can continue to serve the close to a million Oregonians that are on the Oregon Health Plan and have a viable commercial insurance market at the same time. I came here today in order to look at the committee and to say that in good confidence, I believe the 16 CCOs are in a collaborative manner for all parts, very supportive of the tax proposal and the budget solution that's been presented to you today. Would there not be concerns among many of those CCOs and our hospital association, commercial insurance carriers? Yes, there would be, because in something as complicated as we have in front of us today, the devil lies in the details, and that'll unfold over the next 6 months as we try to figure out what is the impact if we go from a federal waiver commitment of 3.4% to hold medical inflation down to 1.8. What does that do in constituting trying to take almost a zero-based rate? And that's the rate we've been told, that we'll probably go from 3.4 down to about 1.8. So no one's aware of that number?
I could probably...
Representative Hayden, would you like to speak?
Senator Hayward, did you...
Well, I'm a little surprised to hear that, considering that my co-chair and I have been discussing this issue for quite some time, and I don't think we got anywhere close to that low a number, Mr. Greenhill, but I don't mean to speak out of turn, but when you said that, it really caught my attention.
I noticed that.
I'm enjoying your testimony. Please continue.
I talk slow. Senator Steinhardt, we believe that's probably a pretty accurate number. It could be 2, but it's going to be lower than 3.4 where we stand now.
I don't disagree, Mr. Greenhill. It's going to be lower than 3.4. Mm-hmm. But 1.8 is markedly lower than I would have
Prepared for something somewhere in
that's
that range.
Good.
But if in the good wisdom of this body, if they can bring it in at 3, we'll gladly take it.
I don't think we're going to get there either. But, okay.
But in the consensus of our discussion, what we're really talking about is the CCOs understand that this is a belt-tightening process that we're going to go into. Now we're challenged with our eligibility, our membership over here, providing the same level of services we've been providing over the last several years now. And at the same time, we're looking at added benefits, added administrative procedures, the federal passage of the Magna laws, the interpretation and promulgation of those rules and regulations by CMS, passed down to our Oregon Health Authority, has brought a number of compounding administrative burdens to the CCOs that we didn't have 2 years ago. Case in point is we proved to the state and the federal government our capacity to provide a network panel. Last year, we had 6 objectives we had to accomplish to identify a stand-up network of all 16 CCOs to know that we had to access for the number of members we were going to treat. Now that is 26 criteria that we have to meet. That is just one minor example of just the bureaucratic governmental creep that we have in administering our programs. That can be overburdensome as we go forward. And in the next 6 months, as we look at how we're going to implement these budget changes and challenges, we're going to have to work very closely together to make sure that we can function under this and that we don't. That's also compounded by additional services that have been added. And if you look at the Hep C protocols, it's been changed least recently down to a stage 2 level of treatment, and that is going to bring hundreds of thousands of dollars of expenses to the CCOs that we didn't have a year ago. Is it something we ought to be treating? Yes. But at the same time, we are going to have to tighten our belts, and we're going to have to learn to run in a lot leaner manner than we are and have been in the past. But again, we appreciate the funding that's there, and we thank the legislature for supporting that funding that's there. And I think that this tax program can work.
All right, questions? Yes, Senator Winters.
I don't have a question, but Mr. Greenhill reminded me of the history of when we began this journey. And I can recall, since I was the author in 2003, and I can recall some of the comments that you're making today were some of the comments that were made by some of the entities that saying that doing the provider assessment would not work, that we would be embarking on a new way of leveraging dollars. There would be some real problems. And not taken into consideration in 2003, we were faced with some of the similar things that we're faced with today, maybe in a different context, but we're faced with today. One, we were faced with totally eliminating the Oregon Health Plan.
Yes, ma'am.
And two, we were embarking on a new journey because we did not know in any way whether or not that we were one of those few states, we weren't 49 states then, that actually did leveraging of those dollars and so what have you. So I'm trying to actually, you know, say we took that leap of faith in 2003, and thanks to the hospitals who stepped up and said yes, because the uncompensated cost, if I can recall the discussion that we were having then, that cost of because we no longer, Hill Burton had gone bye-bye, And so the uncompensated costs just went through the roof, which puts hospitals at the risk of bankruptcy in the state, if I can recall the conversation. And so as a part of that solution was we embarked on this, what we now know as the partnership that occurred with the hospitals and others, and then since then we also have joined the long-term care system. I do hope that all the partners will actually work through all of the things, because certainly they're a reality that we address and we deal with, both talking about, you know, making certain that our rates, that we're not going too high, making certain that we're not overburdening and taxing any one of our systems. But certainly now I think that we have been at this now, but my calculation says we've been at this for 14 years. That perhaps we've got enough lessons learned that in going forward, you know, going into 2017-19, that we're able to get it right. We'll never be able to figure out what they're doing in Washington, D.C., trust me. I don't care who's in charge. But I do appreciate your comments. I really do, because it reminded me of some of the discussion that we were having.
Co-chairs Steiner Haywood and Representative Rayfield, Senator Winters, you're right on target there. And one example we have just in the last 5 years is, and particularly with my DRG hospital at Bay Area Hospital, we've dropped bad debt percentage from 6% to below 2%. That's a significant impact on that margin. I've spent 20 years of my life being a hospital CEO also for managed care. So those numbers can be moved around, and we want healthy hospitals. I think what we've demonstrated, especially this year in this session with this crisis, is the collaborative effort to come together and realize the magnitude of a problem we've got and try to work that out. That doesn't mean that there's not elephants in the room, and that doesn't mean that there's not self-interest in the room. That we all know that that's a reality that we deal with. But so far, we've adjourned every meeting without blood on the floor, and everybody's come back to the table each time we've called those meetings, and we've gone into these numbers. These numbers have not principally changed over the last probably 90 days. This has been a framework that we've been working toward to see if the feasibility is there, and can we make that happen in unison with CMS. And there's still a government federal entity that we've got to negotiate some of these deals with, and we've got to find out where the problem areas are over the next six months. You know, if we can pass this and solve this problem, it's only then that the work's really going to start, as we're going to have to find out, what does it mean today if we're moving closer to a flat budget on the CCOs at the same time we're doing actuarial rate development exercises? And they're not exercises, they're reality. So how do you give somebody a 5% cut and somebody else a 5% raise when your target is a zero-based budget? And when you're talking in the neighborhood, you know, Senator Steiner, whether we're talking 1.8, 2.8, or whatever, we're so close to almost no raise at all that it's really a negative when you see the inflationary impacts of the cost of care today, especially around the pharmaceutical lines and the biologicals that we're dealing with. Most of our pharmacy budgets are just skyrocketing. And question?
Representative Bueller.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Rickman. Mr. Reno, in terms of the belt tightening you'd expect with the CCOs if this goes through, would you anticipate that providers would see a decrease in their reimbursement as a result?
On or off the record? I've raised our physicians that yes, we could be looking at a 10 to 15% drop. Right now, we have been so good in managing care that our physician population is a good solid percentage above Medicare, which is kind of a targeted reimbursement for all providers. And especially on our physician level, they're reimbursed above Medicare. And so there is some preparation, at least, or at least I'm being a good CEO and padding the message that, you know, that there may be some decreases. But there will be some small decreases probably. Is there room to do that? Yeah, I believe there is.
Please.
Double-digit decreases does sound small to me. If it
depends
is
that, on where you start.
If it's in that 10 to 15% range, would you anticipate that there might be access problems for Medicaid patients in finding providers?
No, I would not, because of the system we've designed in our communities. In our community, there's an algorithm of assignment to a physician that participates in our panel, and a Medicaid patient actually has access to a physician before a commercial patient.
Your community, can you speak for the state at large?
I think you would find that pretty true across the panel, but we have had some areas where there's been some deterioration in the participation of treating OHP patients. But I think it's a little spotty. But you know, we've been at this, as Senator Winter said, 14 years. We've been at managed care in this state now for what, 24 years?
24 years.
Yeah. We started specifically in our community in 1994, and so, you know, I don't want to toot our horn too much, but we've become pretty good in this. We have skin in the game. Our physicians are at risk. In our community, there's 60% owners of the CCO. They're 15 to 20% of their caseload. It's an intricate part of their practice and their commitment to their communities. There's a bunch of elements that come together there to make that work. Now, would you find one physician that says it doesn't pay enough? True, but we're somewhere between, in most CCOs, in a broad statement, we're somewhere between Medicare and commercial rates. And that's a healthy position to be in Medicaid. I've worked across this country for 30 years back and forth for the Tenets and the HCAs and all the big systems. I came here from Nevada, where a Medicaid patient could not get in to see a physician because they paid 26 cents on the dollar. You know, I think we ought to look at, were we successful, because the glass is definitely half full. It's not half empty. And yes, but it'll get a little tighter. That's just the reality of it. If you ignore it, you got your head in the sand.
All right. Further questions? Representative Hayden.
Thank you. I have a question pertaining to the caseload assignments of fee-for-service to CCO. We have seen over the last 12 months and more an increase of caseloads held in the fee-for-service side of things versus the CCO assignment, the enrollment, CCO, retroactive payments, and a whole long discussion, not for this committee. But the CCOs have been very concerned about, you know, 100,000 patients or so it's about 150,000 in fee-for-service, and arguably 50,000 of those should probably remain there. But those caseloads aren't in the CCOs, and the global budget, my understanding, is basically a 3.4%, but when you take the CCO inflationary rate, I do agree it's closer to 1.8% for the CCO, not the OHA total package. My question is, because those numbers are difficult to get to, how does it affect your hospitals if you have 10% more in fee-for-service? Is that net neutral to fee-for-service versus being assigned through a CCO?
No, not really, because the complications that come from that is that an open card member in our community, many, many communities, they are on the lower rung of the ladder in getting into provider services. If you have an open card in our community, you have a very, very difficult time of seeing a provider. And we've dealt with that on our specialist side, even with tribal members. That's why we're trying to negotiate contracts for the tribes. And that member then, not being able to see a primary care to manage their caseload, waits to there's a severity of the situation, ends up in the ER. And then the reimbursement is at DMAP rates, which is significantly less than even Medicare. So the hospital is not getting paid what they would get paid if they were seeing a contracted CCO member. So the whole thing there is a little upside down. You open the door for me, so I'll put in a plug. Give us the right at the CEO level to start enrolling members into our CCOs, and let's make this a lot more simple. Let's go back and look at some of the times we used DHS case workers to do some of that. Let's look at simplifying this process, because I'm losing it, trending at 9% down on membership versus last year. Most CCOs are in that 9, 10, 11%. And we think they are trapped over in the open card market. And we went in and into this with the initiative to move people out of open card to CCO care. And we need to accomplish that. So we need to be more part of the solution in making that happen, and we're willing to work with the department to see that we can get there.
Yeah, Senator Hayward.
Thank you. Mr. Greenhill, I understand your concern about enrollment, and I would point out that part of our challenge in that regard is federal law, and we can make some changes on the state law, and we're trying to. We passed a bill out of Senate Health today that's coming our direction down here that would hopefully start to assist in that area. I would also point out that enrollment overall in the entire health plan is down 10%. So, yes, we've got more people on open card than we should, and it's something that my co-chair and I are concerned about, and we'll be adding a key performance measure on with OHA's eager engagement to decrease the percent on open card and move them in back into CCOs, because we agree with you entirely. And there are a variety of steps that OHA is already taking to do that, and also making sure that we get people re-enrolled more quickly so that there aren't lapses with retroactivity onto open card. So we agree with you, but the overall trend with OHP enrollment is down a good 10%.
And we'd like to know why that is. I mean, I've recently had a number of members got jobs, which was wonderful.
Right,
it's one of our goals.
And we actually had this, the Senate Healthcare Committee today had an informational hearing on enrollment and eligibility. As you know, there have been several of those in the past several weeks, and that very question came up. And we believe that it's a combination of factors, and we're still working on analyzing it, but certainly a big chunk of it is our improving economy. People get jobs. They get jobs with insurance. The small group market, small employer mandate has come in since 2014. There are a lot of factors, and people move. Or people marry somebody with health insurance, mm-hmm. or they get a better job. So we're looking at all the reasons, but mostly we think that they're good reasons, and that there isn't that there are eligible people on who should be on OHP who are no longer on OHP.
Yeah, I agree. I think overall we're making a good effort at it. I'm anxious and would like to solve it as fast as possible.
We're working on it.
All right. With that, any other questions? Seeing none.
Well, in conclusion, I'd like to thank to you, Minnie. I often use a quote that I'm fond of, and that is that a country's greatest asset is a healthy populace. And that was quoted by Winston Churchill after World War II, and when he had all the people to put back to work into the factories. So I think we're doing good work, continue to do good work, and we enjoy working with you. So thank you for your support.
Yeah, thank you for making the trip all the way from Coos Bay. All right. With that, Ms. Ames, anything else for the committee? Are you sure?
I'm kidding.
I'd like to know when we're going to have a new meeting.
Oh, we're going to...
Tuesday. Right. There's a meeting scheduled now for Tuesday. It's informational meeting on the Integrated Eligibility Project, which we haven't heard any detail about yet, and a public hearing on Senate Bill 397.
All right. With that, we will go ahead and adjourn the meeting. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.